Samuel Devotee. All glories to this Samuel Devotee. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauri. Hare Krishna. So today, as promised, we will actually go on with the Yashodhanashtha. Just a reminder that the course actually is from 10 o'clock until 11:30. I can go over the time, but you can't. Okay? So everybody please make an effort to come in and be in the room at 10 o'clock. Not 12 minutes past. If you're out of sync with the clock, then correct your time. Okay, so today we're going to do the invocation. We can all chant it. Just to start off with, this is a dictionary explanation of invocation, the act or instance of invoking, especially an appeal to a higher power for assistance. A prayer or other formula used in invoking, as at the opening of a religious service. The act of conjuring up a spirit by incantation, and an incantation used in conjuring. So we are going to appeal to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that is the spirit of the Veda, that, as we said, we're not interested in deduction, but induction. We want to get the blessings of the Supreme Lord and have Him reveal Himself to us. So we're not interested in empirical processes, but rather we're interested in surrendering ourselves and being enlightened by a supreme power. So this verse, we can all chant it together. Om Purnam Purnam Idam Purnam Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. So this is an invocation. The Personality of Godhead is perfect and complete because He is completely perfect. All emanations from Him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Whatever is produced of the complete whole is also complete in itself. Because He is the complete whole, even though so many complete units emanate from Him, He remains the complete balance. So, we're not going to read the whole purport. This is about the shortest purport in the whole of the Ishapanishad. It's interesting, though, that Prabhupada uses the word complete about 30 times in this one short purport. So I highlighted a couple of the important points there. Realization of the Personality of Godhead is realization of all the transcendental features, Satchit Ananda, bliss. When one realizes the Supreme Person, he realizes these aspects of the Absolute Truth in their completeness. So in other words, Mayavad and the yogic processes are not complete. Bhakti is the complete process because it recognizes the Personality of Godhead. We spoke about this the other day. Who can remember the stages? Satchit Ananda. What did we say the other day? It'll come up in this anyway. Yes.
Satchit Ananda meditation.
Yes.
Siddhi
Paramatma. Yes.
And Ananda.
Yes. These correspond. Satchit and Ananda, they correspond with Brahman realization, Paramatma realization, and Bhagavan realization. So this phenomenal world is also complete in itself. The 24 elements of which this material universe is a temporary manifestation are arranged to produce everything necessary for the maintenance and sustenance of this universe. And we're going to focus on that particular aspect today. I'll go on to that in a minute. All facilities are given to the small complete units, namely the living beings. Human form of life is a complete manifestation of the consciousness of the living being. That's a very interesting statement the Prabhupada makes there. In other words, this is the platform of which completeness can actually be understood. Yeah. Of course, human form and higher species. But this is the species where we get the opportunity to make our incomplete lives complete by understanding the personality of Godhead. Therefore, Prabhupada said that in all the species of life, human species is the only one that has an educational system and a religious system. You don't find that in the lower species. It's only when you become a human being, then you get this expanded consciousness. So, because we do not know there is a complete arrangement in nature for our maintenance, we make efforts to utilize the resources of nature to create a so-called complete life of sense enjoyment. So that is another key phrase, because that is the whole endeavor of material science. That there's a perception of incompleteness, and therefore they think that they have to make their own arrangements for this sense enjoyment. Therefore they're engaged in exploiting the material world, trying to improve things. They think that nature is not complete. It is not sufficient to supply to us what we need. Therefore we need technology, we need industrialization, we need to invent so many different appliances to improve our sense gratification. This is the whole mentality of modern science. But Prabhupada's saying it because people don't know that. There is already a complete arrangement. Material nature provides what we want for the satisfaction of our senses to the degree that we can keep body and soul together. That, and that only, is the limit of sense enjoyment. To keep body and soul together. Dharma, artha, karma, moksha. So that calm, that satisfaction of the senses, comes as a result, actually, of dharma, prescribed duty. And then as a result of that, there's a reciprocation from the demigods. Material nature works in such a way as to supply to us all our daily needs for eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. And the balance of time should be utilized for higher understanding, pursuit of higher understanding of what we are, so that we can come to the point of moksha, ultimately. Dharma, artha, karma, and moksha. Sorry, artha is the economic development. Means krishi gauraksha. And then karma is that satisfaction. And then moksha is the actual goal. So the completeness of human life can be realized only when one engages in the service of the complete whole. So unless we can realize completeness, then we're always looking here and there, we're always inventing, speculating, and doing so many things. Which actually, as Prabhupada says in the Krishna Consciousness Happening album, that people are actually making so many arrangements that they're just becoming lost in the complexity of material nature. That's all. And for every arrangement that we make for our sense gratification to so-called improve things, we make five times as many problems. Because we don't recognize the completeness of nature. So we're going to look at this. There are 31 mentions of complete in that little purport there. Prabhupada, there are a series of additional notes. Somebody's very kindly in the folio gone through and pulled out a lot of wherever Prabhupada's mentioned Purna in different lectures, letters, whatever. So I'm not going to read all of those, but there's a couple of things that I have highlighted, and this is one of them. That he is so complete, just like the sun's heat has been distributed for millions and millions of years, still it is full of heat. Here, unless the electric power is there, it is not complete. But there is power in the sunshine. It is a reservoir of so much heat and light that for millions and millions of years it has been distributing it. The seasonal changes are going on. The green foliage is coming again. The snow and rain is coming, and so many things are going on in the count of heat. Any machine is rolling. Just as there is power, the machine is rolling. In all machines, your bodily machine, my bodily machine, an electric machine, another powered machine, everything is going on. Purna, purnam, udachite. And in spite of taking so much energy from the sun, it is still full of light and energy. This is one of the creations of the Supreme. So how perfect is the Supreme? So Prabhupada's pointing to material nature there as an example. Here again, he uses this famous mathematical equation, 1 minus 1 equals 1. Yeah, and 1 plus 1 equals 1, not 2. This is completeness. So now let's go on a little bit. I'll just flash through these guys here. Professor, now the universe is... Sorry.
I just... One plus one equals two.
Yes. And that means it's complete. Yes. Why 1 plus 1 equals 2? Because if you say 1 plus 1 equals 2, then it means there's an addition to the original 1. But in God, there's no additions or subtractions. 1 minus 1 is 1. 1 plus 1 is 1. Yeah. In other words, there's a complete whole there. There's no additions, there's no subtractions. You cannot reduce or increase. God is everything. Yeah? In the Upanishad, it is said, Purnam Ada Purnam Idam. Purnam Udachate. In the creation of Krishna, there cannot be any scarcity. Everything is sufficiently there. Purnam, it is complete, perfectly made. This planet, that planet. Everywhere, the living entities are there, and Krishna has made a provision for every one of them. So that completeness in nature we're going to see now. Here another quote from Prabhupada. You see from the birds, animals, nobody dies of starvation. Ekabahunam nyobidadati kama. Krishna is there, he is supplying food for everyone. There's no question of starvation. God's creation is perfect. Otherwise, there is no problem. You see how jolly they are. They are walking. So by nature study, we can learn. So we're going to have a little bit of nature study this morning. We're going to have a couple of movies in a minute. If we don't go to the Vedic knowledge, so even Prabhupada said, if we don't go to the Vedic knowledge, you don't need to go to the Vedas to see that where is the problem for the lower animals. In other words, if you study material nature, you can understand the completeness of God. This statement, Purna, that everything is complete. This is a very important principle in science. It's very important. We'll go on to that in a minute. There is no problem. They are confident. The problems for the lower animals are there when they are in the city. But if they live in the natural life, there's no problem. Yeah. The lower animals and the human beings, if you're living in the city, you make a problem. But if you're in tune with nature, there's no problem. And now we'll go on. I think that was the last quote that I picked out from there. See, there's a lot of stuff. Now we'll go on to a couple of points. This is on that point about material nature, or living naturally. This is a discussion Prabhupada had with Bali Madan Das. He just bought a farm in Australia, New Govardhan Farm. He was giving him a report. Prabhupada was asking, yes, so he can get fruits to eat, good appetite, yes, yes. And Bali Madan says, when we were flying over Australia, when you first came there, that was in 71, you pointed downwards and you said, you get some land here and maintain cows and everything. And Prabhupada's saying, yes, oh, you remember it. And Bali Madan says, yes, I was thinking, so I must fulfill this instruction. And then Prabhupada quotes Purnam Idam. Everything is complete by the arrangement of Krishna. Simply, we mismanage, that's all. I do not know why people are engaged with politics, fighting, and so on, so on. By Krishna's grace, everything is complete. You eat sufficiently, you be strong, and keep your health good and chant Hare Krishna. This is the arrangement. These rascals, they have created civilization, simply animosity, fighting and politics. This is Kali Yuga. Now that fighting is there for a particular reason. Again, Prabhupada goes on, and he attributes that business of politics and fighting where? At their university education. Maya Aparita. Useless knowledge. Useless. Aparita Jnana. Unless they have, actually they have no knowledge. Why? The only fault is that there is no God. Asuram Bhavam Ashrita. So this is the basic fault. Everyone is trying. Oh, there is no God. Science. Yeah, this is the alternative. This is the basic principle. So the whole human society is suffering on account of these fools and rascals. So in a godless civilization, what do you expect? You can only have disturbance and fighting. This is the problem. So they presented a view of the universe that the universe is incomplete. It's incomplete. And therefore it's begun in a kind of crude form, and now it's evolving and improving as it evolves. And as it improves more and more, we get more and more completeness. So evolution is the principle. But this is directly the opposite of the statement of the Sri Shapanishad, which invocation, right from the very beginning, on Purna, everything is Purna, it is already complete. You don't require to add or subtract anything, just accept the arrangement that God has given, and you'll be happy. But if you're not accepting that completeness, if you think everything is incomplete, then you'll strive to make so-called improvements and additions, and then you'll fight and you'll argue because everything's incomplete. So when we feel some incompleteness, then we want something. But what I want may be what you want, and then who's going to have it? And then we fight. Palestine, yeah, there are all these different places, that, you know, Iraq, fighting over oil, all these businesses. Now, I just saw in the news this morning that President Bush is going to give his State of Union address, and he's going to tell people that we're actually too much addicted to oil. Too much addicted to oil. We have to wean ourselves off our addiction to oil. They realize, actually, that it's not a good thing. At the same time, the man who's saying that has sent the whole army, you know, into one of the major oil-producing countries to protect their interests. You know? Because without oil, we are incomplete. This is the mentality. It's a problem. They don't have a real understanding of God, actually, but Prabhupada was giving it. So, I just fished this little quote out from the Telegraph 2 days ago. What went right in human evolution? Carl Zimmer seeks the answer. Evolutionary biologists generally agree that humans and other species have descended from bacteria-like ancestors. Bacteria, that was our ancestors. So complete. Yes. But about 2 million years ago, human ancestors branched off. This new group, called eukaryotes, also gave rise to other plants, fungi, and protozoans. If we say, no, the Prajapatis, yeah, they produced all the different species, they'll say, oh, ridiculous mythology. But a bacteria can produce so many different species. No problem. Everybody thinks evolution is natural selection, and that's it, Michael Lynch, a biologist at Indiana University, said. But that's just one of several fundamental forces. In a paper accepted for publication in the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution, Lynch argues that eukaryotes' complexity may have gotten started by chance. So this is the sum and substance. These are the guys at the very heart, you know, of science, molecular biology, that we come from bacteria, and things may have got started by chance. Right, so now, there are a group of scientists that are starting to challenge this. And they're starting to make statements like this one by Michael Behe. How can we decide whether Darwinian natural selection can account for the amazing complexity that exists on the molecular level? Darwin himself set the standard when he acknowledged, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous, successive, slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. So this man is saying, some systems seem very difficult to form by such successive modifications, and I call them irreducibly complex. So we are now going to see one such system, if I can get this film working properly. This guy. Right, now let's see what we have to say. giraffe. Can everybody see that? We need the sound. Don't make any noise. No, we haven't got... Okay, we've lost the soundtrack. What's happening?
Oh, Lord.
Why have we not got a soundtrack?
Do you have it on computer?
Yeah.
The heart of a bull giraffe can be as much as 2.5 feet long. The whole pump.
Did he say the heart?
18-foot tall creature decides, I need a drink of water. So he bends his head down to get a drink of water. Now we have a problem. Because now this powerful pump, instead of pumping against gravity, is pumping with gravity. And so the heart gives a mighty squeeze, and the blood shoots down his neck, hits his brain, and bursts his brain. And so now he just blew his brains out. Okay, so he's dying, and he must be thinking to himself, I need to evolve something here to take care of my problem. When I get a drink of water, I blow my brains out. Of course, you know, dead creatures don't evolve. But he doesn't blow his brains out, because as he bends his head down, there are like little spigots in his artery that goes up the neck, little valves, and they close. But the last pump is beyond the last valve. And so it's enough to burst the little arterioles in his brain, but it doesn't go into his brain. The last pump kind of goes whoop underneath the brain into like a sponge. And this sponge just gently expands, and he hasn't blown his brains out. He gets his drink of water, and now he sees a zebra kind of running up from this side, and he just ignores it. But he sees a lion coming up from this side. Oh, the lion wants to eat me. I got to get out of here. Now, how does he know the difference, by the way? Evolutionists can't explain that to us. But the fact is, here comes this lion. He's going to eat the giraffe. And so the giraffe jumps up. He runs about 5 steps, passes out. Not enough oxygen to his brain. While he's there, passed out. The lion is eating him. He must be thinking, I need to evolve something here. I got this problem. I pass out when I get up too fast. But he doesn't, of course. Well, why? Well, because God made him so that when he begins to bring his head up, the little spigots, the little valves in the artery open, the sponge under the brain gently squeezes that last little pump of oxygenated blood up into his brain. There are little valves in the vein that goes down the neck. They close, and by the time he's up and running, everything is fine, his blood pressure is fine, and he does just fine. Well, how would that evolve? He needs all of those parts, all there, all at the same time, all at once, or he's dead. And so I think the giraffe is another example of a designer. He needed a designer to design him just like he is.
Okay, so that's the giraffe. Now, interesting point there that he's making is that you need the complete system all at once. You can't evolve in step by step. He's got an 18-foot neck, he's got a huge heart, and it gives off tremendous surges of blood to get the blood up to the head. It's very powerful, but as soon as he lowers his head, he blows his brains out because it's too powerful. Because now it's going downwards, not upwards. But then all he has all this little system of valves, and it checks the pressure, and then the last little spurt, in order to not damage the brain cells, it goes into a sponge-like sac, and then that gently floods the brain with blood, and it keeps consciousness. And then when he puts his head back up again, then instead of passing out due to the loss of blood pressure, right, there's a little reservoir of blood in the sac that remains there, and then as soon as he puts his head up, that's released. It keeps his brain oxygenated, and then the blood starts to come up again through the valve system. The valves open up and he's okay. So how do you evolve that system? This is the question that these scientists are asking. Unless you have all the component parts all in one go, then you don't have a giraffe, right? Let's say somehow or another there's a giraffe, an original giraffe. But if he doesn't have the complete system, then how is he going to get baby giraffes? Because he's dead in 5 seconds. So there are what he calls, this Bebe calls, irreducible complexity, immaterial nature. You cannot explain these things by evolutionary theories. It's this successive, graduated progression. It has to be complete at the very beginning. If the system is not complete at the very beginning, it can't work. So this is the challenge. Because the Ishapanishad is saying this. What now these men, they're these, as you heard him say about a design, an intelligent design. So they're observing in nature, and that was one of the points that Prabhupada said. You just look at nature. Look at the animals. See how they're living. Not just superficially, but however deeply you go into looking at them, you'll see this completeness of work. This is evidence of the existence of God. It cannot have come about by ordinary chance, so-called chance, and just gradual developments. These systems have too many component parts that all have to work all at the same time, in conjunction with each other, perfectly, in order for that animal to exist. So how do you explain that? And no evolutionary biologist can actually explain it. They do return challenges. It's not that they're sitting back and saying, oh wow, yeah, you're right. But the guy that was just on there used to be an evolutionary biologist. He was teaching biology in 1971. And he was explaining to students how teeth evolved from fish scales. Right, that was his class. And then afterwards, two students approached him and said, have you ever heard of creation theology, or creation biology? And then he said no. So then they introduced him to it. After 5 years of studying it, he gave up being an evolutionist and became, you know, a Christian, because he's a Christian. But, you know, he accepted that these things actually have to be designed. They can't just spring about by chance. Now we'll have a look at a couple of other things. In 1977, we were in Bhubaneswar with Srila Prabhupada, and we had a visit to the zoo. Interesting visit. On January the 24th, Bhagwat arranged for Prabhupada to have his walk at the local zoo. Prabhupada wasn't so keen, but he went there because we have not yet found a good place to walk. When we arrived, we first went to the big cat section, where there were two cages side by side with lions in them. A whole family was in one of them. From Prabhupada's reaction, it was obvious he was not happy to see them locked up in their tiny cells, and he didn't linger long. Still, he did point out that although they are very powerful, ferocious animals, they are living peacefully together. He knows who is family member, and they do not fight. At that moment, the keeper came and threw in some freshly killed goat for them, and they all began to chew it up and eat it. As soon as the meat is thrown, Prabhupada said, immediately they will eat, but they do not attack each other. His point was is that he has often made that all living beings are spirit souls and are sentient, not simply chemical combinations thrown together by evolution. Even in lower species, this consciousness is evident but simply covered. As he made his observation, this is a side point, but it's funny, so I included it. As he made his observation, the devotees gathered around to hear. Guru Kripa and one or two of his men were at the other cage trying to provoke one of the animals and make it snarl. When it did become annoyed, and Prabhupada's attention was suddenly called, he said quite sharply, "Do not tease." And then he added as he walked away, "After all, he is a lion." Prabhupada is respectful to all living beings because of his compassion. He doesn't like to see them taken advantage of unfairly because they are in a bad situation. After he completed his walk around the zoo and we drove back to our land, as the car neared the entrance, he asked us, "So, what is the lesson from this visit to the zoo?" Getting no reply, Prabhupada said, "The lesson is that the lion is a prisoner. Therefore, no matter how strong one may be, there is always some greater control." So that's an interesting point there. Now, that Prabhupada was making the point that they're eating the goat, but they're not eating each other. First of all, the male lion, he chewed, then the female lions, then the cubs. So there's a pecking order there. But each one got something, not like the male lion ate everything and then nothing left for the others. There was a sense. Prabhupada said there's a sense of family there, so there's some affection, actually in a crude form. So this is another aspect of completeness. In the first example we saw of the giraffe, we see the mechanisms. Yeah, and how all the mechanisms have to all be there at one time for a, you know, a creature to exist. But they're more than just mechanisms. And this is what we're looking at now. On January the 30th, then, of course this was a special day actually, at 2:50 a.m. Prabhupada finished the 9th canto and began the summary of the chapters for the 10th canto. Today is Ekadasi, but it is observed tomorrow because that is Mahadwadasi. Swarup Damodar came in the evening. Prabhupada called him straight in and began conversing about science. Swarup Damodar showed Prabhupada some slides that he had used in a lecture about the origin of life. The seminar was at a university in Atlanta and attended by many important men. He said at the end, all of them were completely silent because his philosophy was so strong. He explained how modern science says that action and reaction is simply a series of chemical pushes and pulls. However, he showed a picture of a crocodile hatching an egg in its mouth by gently rolling it back and forth until it hatches, and then the young one jumps out of its mouth and swims ashore. Therefore, there is definitely a feeling of love and affection, not just impersonal, mechanical pushes and pulls. Prabhupada liked the presentation very much and gave the example of the lions that we saw the other day, how they were living together, a whole family, without any fighting. So now we're going to look at this very example that Swarup Damodar had, in fact, presented to Prabhupada about the crocodile. If I can get this to work. Keep your fingers crossed. Just so it was working before I came here. Somehow or another we got a blank out. This is the one, let me see if it comes up. Alright, just give me a sec. I have to close this down. And restart it.
As soon as the sands on top of them have been cleared away.
and the tiny crocodile babies emerge. At this point, a very surprising thing happens. The mother opens her huge jaw with its sharp teeth and takes the baby in her mouth. The first scientists who witnessed this knew that the crocodiles were eating their young. Whereas the truth is very different. The safest place on the shore for the babies is in their mother's mouth. Very carefully and gently, the mother takes her babies one by one into her mouth. The newborn babies literally beg to enter their mother's mouth. Also takes the unhatched eggs in her mouth and squeezes them just hard enough to crack the shells. These razor-sharp teeth can tear a buffalo or antelope to pieces. The pressure a crocodile's teeth can produce when biting its prey reaches spectacular dimensions. Yet she behaves so sensitively and carefully when taking its young into its jaws that those teeth never do them any harm. Once the mother has filled her mouth with her babies, she returns to the river. She goes to a safe and shallow bank she has already selected. She then carefully opens her mouth and shakes her head. She gently drops the babies and unhatched eggs in the water. And the water is suddenly full of tiny crocodiles. When it comes time for her eggs to hatch, a creature as fierce and savage as a crocodile turns into a mother full of love and care for her babies. Babies are now under their mother's protection at all times.
Now, this is the next interesting thing, right? That's her babies. Same example that Prabhupada observed about the lions. For their own young, they recognize this is different. This is not goat meat. Right, this is not food. This is actually, there's some sense there that they're related, they have to care for them, etc., and bring them up. But the surprising thing about the crocodile, it actually goes even beyond that.
Crocodile nest that around that time, things are happening under the ground. Turtle eggs under the sand crack open, and a tiny baby is slowly come to the surface. These tiny creatures are totally defenseless. They need to enter the water at once if they are to survive. And they miraculously begin to rush towards the water as soon as they hatch. Straightens the turtle, which has come the wrong way round. then, surprisingly, the crocodile carries the lost baby turtle to the water it has failed to find. The feelings of love that God has inspired in this predator save not only its own offspring, but the tiny baby turtle too. God created every living thing in the world, and every...
So that's... Now, how do you explain that by evolution? As Swarup Damodar was saying, according to science, everything is just chemical pushes and pulls, chemical reactions. Yeah? They don't recognize the sentience of living beings and the uniqueness of life beyond material nature. But how do you explain something like that? So this is another form of completeness. Not just that the mechanism itself has to be complete, but you have to also account for the emotion. You have to account for the sentience of living beings, their ability to recognize their own family members, other living beings. And this kind of, as he says, this is called altruism in material nature. So, only when you come to the point, you know, to the point of understanding that God exists and that he is, everything has come from Krishna, can you actually account for all these things. Material scientists cannot account for all this different kind of phenomena. So they try to, you know, explain it away with jugglery of words. But when you really, really get down to, you know, the essence of what they're saying, they don't have an explanation. They fall very, very far short of it. So the Ishapanishad is a challenge to the scientists. Just with its invocation, it's declaring immediately everything is complete. The scientists, their whole thing is that everything is incomplete. So they're diametrically opposed. And therefore Prabhupada said that we have to challenge them. Yeah, we have to come forward and show these examples and then relate that back, you know, to the Shastra. Yes, Prabhupada.
I have a question. I also, like, I had some discussion with such evolutionists, and then I also ask, how can you explain love in nature? Because it's really difficult. It's also like it's affection. It's not really. I mean, well, how can they explain? But then they say, like this little tiny form of a baby invokes in every living entity a special sentiment of, oh, this is so small, this is so tiny, so cute, so it needs protection, and because. If you're small, it is like you need protection, otherwise you cannot survive. So therefore, somehow others, it is like the sense is there. When we see a little baby or a little cat or a little dog, we always feel like affection automatically. It's something installed in our brain that they say something like this. So how can we defeat these arguments?
Well, so what is that? What is that that's installed in your brain?
Yeah.
What is that sentiment? What is that sense of affection? You have to explain it. That is due to the consciousness of the living being. See, it gets back to consciousness. And when you look at, you know, modern biologists or physicists or chemists or whatever, they fall very far short of coming up with any kind of reasonable explanation of what consciousness is. Where does consciousness come from? How does it actually, how is it a product of chemical interaction? Consciousness has unique features. Feeling, emotion, you know, affection, all these things. So where does that come from? Anger. We don't see chemicals, you know, becoming angry with each other. Or, you know, getting cozy with each other. They're chemicals, that's all. You put chemicals in the test tube, they react. There's some chemical reaction. But you don't get any, you know, sense of consciousness coming from that. So what is consciousness? Where does it come from? So that area of science, they have practically no explanation. They try to come up with different things about, you know, the interactions of the brain and all of these, you know, various speculations. But none of them come anywhere close to actually explaining what consciousness is. So our position is that consciousness is unique. It's already there. It's complete. Consciousness is complete. The physical form that the consciousness occupies then lends itself to the intent of the consciousness, not the other way around. Not that the forms come first and then the consciousness comes as a result of the combination of the chemicals. The combination comes as a result of the presence of consciousness. But Prabhupada told Swarupananda that he said, if you can just prove this one thing, that we're not this body, then all material science is finished. Yeah? Don't even talk about God. Just show that the living being is different from the body. That there's a different energy, spiritual energy, and then all the material science is all finished. And Darwin, you know, admitted that. That if you can show that there's something so complex that it can't come about as a result of natural selection, then my whole theory is finished. But, of course, people have taken the ball. Now they say, no, there's more than just natural selection. There are many other forces at work. But when you get into it with them, what are those forces? They have no explanation. It still doesn't. They're hedging around the real question. What is consciousness? Where does it come from? Yes, Philip.
But another argument they can bring is that it's all arranged by the laws of nature. So it's all arranged that all these animals, they just get different signals to act in different way in different circumstances, and there's no consciousness, just chemical, you know, reaction at a certain time because nature kind of controls everything.
So what is nature, and how does nature act in such precise ways?
And they say it's by chance evolved.
Yes. So when you say by chance, it means you're admitting you don't know. Yeah. That's an admittance that you don't know. It just happened by chance. That means you don't know. You have no explanation. So you use this word chance. It may have happened by chance. That's an admittance right there that they don't know. And when you pin them down, and that's what Prabhupada used to do every time, they talk so many words, and this man is writing a whole article, right, that's going out in this biological journal, big important journal. And what does it get down to? It may have happened by chance. So when, in other words, you can stick him on that point that you cannot prove anything. This is all just speculation. As soon as you say it may have happened, could be like this, immediately you're admitting you actually don't know. You're just guessing. So it's not very difficult actually to defeat them and get them to admit that you don't know what you're talking about. You're just speculating. Yeah. Now if you read Human Devolution by Dhritakarma Prabhu, he covers all the different aspects of physics and chemistry and biology and whatever, quantum mechanics, all these different things, in essence, RNA, DNA, and all these different arguments that they've been building up to try to show that life comes from matter. And every one of them falls short. None of them is an actual truth. That's the point. And anybody that really goes into the detail of it, you can find out what their limitations are. See, Prabhupada said, I'm not a scientist, I don't know the scientific jargon and methodology. But I am confident, on the basis of the Veda, that I can challenge every one of them. So he could immediately expose the limitation of their knowledge, immediately. Just by, you know, observation. Chance, could be this, maybe that. And that's it, then they have nothing more to say. As soon as you get them on that one point, they have nothing more to say. You just keep hammering them on the weakest point. Yeah? That you don't know what consciousness is. You have no idea. You have never shown that life comes from a combination of chemicals. Although life is appearing millions and millions and millions of times all around us, every day. But you cannot produce one single life form, living form, from any combination of chemicals. All the chemical ingredients are all available. And after 100 years of proclaiming life, you know, comes about as chemical combination, you haven't shown a single thing, not a bacteria, not a maggot, you know, a mosquito, anything. Prabhupada said, just produce one mosquito, then we'll believe you. Yeah. But God has produced so many mosquitoes, they can fly in the air, you know, do so many things. You know, such a wonderful creation. He has a pipe, he lands on your skin within 1 second, he's gone right through your skin, he's sucking out your blood. Little tiny mosquito, you can just give him a slap and he's finished. But he has this particular arrangement, he can suck out your blood, no problem, within a second. So, you know, Prabhupada used nature a lot, nature study, to defeat this idea. And this is the curse of the world, as he's saying. All the problems in the world are caused by this idea that everything is incomplete. And therefore we have to fight for everything. Yeah. When you realize everything is complete, there's no more fighting, because your arrangement is already there. You simply have to see it, that's all, and live according to it. That this is actually the real peace formula. Yes, Bruno.
What I'm thinking about is one main argument of this evolutionist is also like everything is for the under the principle of maintenance of the human race or the particular race. So everything is underlying this main principle, and even like something like affection and family is only to maintain this particular form of life, and because like small babies they need protection. But even then, this so-called love and affection sometimes oversteps this barrier, where like the mother, for example, sacrifices herself for the maintenance of her baby or for others, and then we cannot really explain this. And yeah, it's there, it's really difficult. And I thought of especially this topic of love and affection is very, very hard to deal with for this evolutionist.
Yes. Well, we'll come to this now. That's the next little bit that I'm going to go on to in this particular movie. How do we get this back on? There we go. Let's just continue on. Now, there's a statement by Darwin that we're going to look at. It comes up after a couple of minutes. Yes, okay. I have a problem with this particular program, is it's difficult to jump ahead to the sections that I want. So I'm just going to have to let it play through. Let's see.
Behaves in the manner decreed by him. In one verse, God reveals, everyone in the heavens and earth belongs to him. Submissive to him.
This is the most wonderful scholar who put this stuff together. His name is Haranyaya.
One of the finest examples of a link between mother and baby can be seen in dolphins. The mother prepares her baby for all kinds of danger. And she is obliged to be strict with it while doing so, albeit unwillingly. These young dolphins are racing a boat. One of the young dolphins unwittingly draws too close. The propeller or hull could do it serious damage. The mother spots the danger and immediately draws up alongside the youngster. It pushes it down to the bottom of the sea. The angry mother sends out high-frequency sound waves to the youngster's body with her nose. These waves both indicate the mother's anger and cause the youngster a measure of discomfort. The youngster is very unhappy. After that stern reprimand, the mother begins to swim alongside it and affectionately rubs one fin against his. That is the dolphin equivalent of holding hands. By doing so, she shows the youngster that she loves it. The knowledge of God has increased. thing and every inanimate object. In one verse, God reveals, and no food emerges from its husk, nor does any female get pregnant or give birth without his knowledge. That there is a pitiless fight for survival among living things. According to the theory, the strong win and the weak are defeated and eliminated. Charles Darwin, the founder of the theory, based his idea of the so-called fight for survival on the concept of natural selection.
The natural selection or the preservation of favored races in the struggle for life. So now if that was true, then why would the crocodile look after the turtle and put it in its mouth and take it out and put it into the water and look after it? See, that kind of sentiment is not explainable by Darwin's theory. His whole thing falls apart when you actually look at what's really going on in nature. Of course, different species are eating each other. Jivo, Jivasya, Jivanam, the Bhagavatam also mentions that one living being is food for another. But beyond getting your food, all the different species continue to exist. It's not that one species is totally wiping out another species. You know, like all the crocodiles have gone on a rampage and just eat everything inside, and there's nothing left in the River Nile except crocodiles. You know, it's not true. There are many other living species which are all living side by side, and beyond what they need for the maintenance of their bodies, they don't do anything. So this is the defect that he has there, the struggle for life. This is the idea of material science. Everything is a struggle, that we're at war with material nature. Material science means that human beings are at war with material nature. We're struggling for existence, fittest survive, so we have to use our technology to subdue everything. And then we'll come out on top. So this is what they're trying to do. They're trying to manipulate material nature. But as soon as they try to manipulate the natural arrangements, just like nowadays, there's gene technology. What is the motivation behind that? That there is an imperfection, an incompleteness in material nature. That God didn't give us tomatoes that will stay on the supermarket shelf for 1 year without going wrong. Right? So for our economic development, we need that. Yeah, the supermarket manager, he has to save money. So he wants a tomato that will stay on the shelf for 6 or 9 months or a year. So manipulate the genes. This is what they're using science for. Change the genetic structure of wheat, of rice, yeah, or grow some kind of rice that's not affected by different kinds of insects. And then you have, you know, an immune rice crop. And you get more yield. And then you make more profit. That's what it's all about, profit. I was in China in 1998. And somebody pointed out to me that wherever you go, there are no birds. Yeah? There are no birds. Like here, you got it. I see so many birds. But in China, you don't see any birds. Why? Because the farmers found that the birds were eating, you know, some of their crops. So they invented this sonic machine. The birds come, and then as soon as they come in range of this machine, boom, they drop dead. Kills them. That's sound. So they put it out. Oh, very good. Now we'll increase our yield. So all the birds came. They all got killed. Yeah. But then what happened? Can anybody think what happens if there are no birds?
The insect.
Yes. Then all the insects went wild because there's no more birds to feed on it. So the balance immediately is altered. Yeah, so that became a bigger problem than the birds were. And now they have a problem trying to repopulate the birds. Or in Australia, they have a big problem with cane toads. The cane toad is about this big. They're really ugly, ferocious, nasty beasts. And the particular feature about them is that they're highly poisonous. So they have no natural predators, because anything that tries to eat them dies.
Is it a frog?
Yeah. It's a toad. Yeah, a toad. Like a frog, same thing. And they brought them in from Hawaii because they were growing sugarcane crops. And there was some particular kind of bug that was, you know, attacking the sugarcane. So they thought, well, bring in the cane toad and it will eat the fly and we'll get nice sugarcane, no problem. But now, the sugarcane, the whole area now, all northern Australia, and now not just in the sugarcane areas, but what they found is that these toads also breed very quickly. Yeah, so they're advancing about 10 miles every year, further and further into Australia. And as they go along, all the little animals, you know, the foxes and the badgers and the this and the that, that naturally, you know, there's that balance there. They eat each other, live off each other, but when they eat the cane toad, they all drop dead. The only thing that's left is the cane toad. So it's creating a huge problem. The whole ecology of the countries, you know, in those areas is going haywire. So these are, you know, man-made ideas. Interference with the complete systems that God has already provided, Krishna has already provided. So genetic engineering is just another example of that. And then later on you'll see that it will be discovered that due to eating genetically altered food, that it's having some radically but unforeseen, right, effect on the genetic structure of the living beings that live on that food. It has to. It has to change it. Yeah? All these different living units, they're all complete units. They all work as a complete whole also. You start playing around with it, then you'll get unforeseen results. And therefore, Prabhupada said that we are simply, although we're trying to control material nature, we are simply becoming entangled in its complexity. You come up with one solution for a so-called problem, and you end up with five more problems. That's the difficulty. And it's all because of this demon. Or one of them.
I was just told that in Mayapur, they put in the computers out now. And they have a thing that catch waves, or phone, different things. And the coconut, the doves, they have a new line on them. It changes the structure of the coconut, of the doves. And they don't know what the effects are, but there's a new line on them that's created by
the radio waves from the transmission towers. Yeah. Yeah, and also we already know that any animals that live or are born underneath these high-powered electricity lines, they get all kinds of birth defects. That's already been established. And anything that lives within a certain distance from these high power pylons, 22,000 volt power lines, then they get so many different birth defects in humans also, and animals have noticed. So this is all, you know, changing the natural order. And people, you know, complain. There was one conversation Prabhupada had, somebody was saying that, well, why didn't God make everything, you know, complete? And Prabhupada said he has made it all complete. The problem is that you can't recognize it, that's all. And now you think that there's some problem with it and you try to change it. If you just leave things as they are and agree to live in harmony with nature. And that's what people did for thousands of years. On the basis that God has given us this, you know, arrangement. And living, we're also part of God. Nature is also part of God. We live in harmony with nature. We accept whatever is provided for us, that will be the next verse, Ishubasha. Then, you know, we can live very nicely. We don't need anything extra. It's all been provided for us. But as soon as you abandon that principle, you're in a big fight. And who's going to win? If you want to fight with material nature, who is going to win? But these rascals are convinced that they'll subdue material nature. Child's play. That's all. Let's have a look and see a bit further on this one what somebody else has to say about this.
Yet Darwin, who lived in the 19th century and whose chances of making observations were extremely limited, was badly wrong. Natural selection has no evolutionary force at all, and furthermore, there is no such ruthless war in nature as Darwin has claimed. Most weak individuals are protected by stronger ones, and different species help one another. As you have seen in this film, parents protect their babies, the weakest and most defenseless things in the world, at the cost of their lives. The theory of evolution that has already collapsed in the face of modern science is even further demolished by these observations in nature. Of the theory of evolution, Professor Cemal Yıldırım, one of Turkey's most prominent evolutionists, implicitly admits that maternal love cannot be explained by blind chance or natural selection. Is there any possibility of accounting for a mother's love for her young by a blind mechanism, that is, natural selection, with no psychological component? There is no doubt that Darwinists are hard put to provide a satisfactory answer to this question. Although it is not scientific, the idea that nature consists solely of a relentless struggle for survival has been blindly defended by evolutionists, and some have even attempted to apply it to human life. Such people, devoid of such concepts as love, affection and compassion that religion brings with it, have maintained that weak, handicapped, and sick people are condemned to elimination by natural selection, and that they have no right to life. Historically, the most prominent supporter of the idea was Ernst Haeckel, the most important proponent of Darwinism in Germany. In his book, Wonders of Life, Haeckel proposed the destruction of abnormal newborn infants without hesitation. He wanted all the sick and deformed, who may be an obstacle to the so-called evolution of society, not just children, to be eliminated as a requirement of the laws of evolution. He complained that hundreds of thousands of incurable lunatics, lepers, people with cancer, etc., are artificially kept alive in our modern communities without the slightest profit to themselves or to the general body. Redemption from evil should be accomplished by a dose of some painless and rapid poison. These Marxist ideas of Hegel were taken up by Adolf Hitler's Nazi Germany, and tens of thousands of innocent people were killed on the grounds that they were sick or handicapped, and represented an obstacle to the so-called evolution of the German race. These graves belonged to people murdered by the Nazis because they allegedly represented an obstacle to evolution. A century or so after Haeckel, Professor Ali Demirsoy, a prominent Turkish evolutionist, surprisingly supports the same idea. Demirsoy says that evolutionary biologists need to conduct genetic tests on babies in their mother's wombs and kill those which they regard as flawed without allowing them to be born. Demirsoy describes himself as a biological fascist and says, "If you ask me, I'm a biological fascist, and those babies who exhibit such features at the fourth month of pregnancy need to be terminated."
Solutions to the Turkish problems from...
As we have seen, evolutionists cite nature in support of their inhuman ideas such as killing a handicapped baby. Yet when we look at nature and animal behavior, we see that evolutionists are mistaken. And that...
Okay, so... That's where it leads to. Yeah, abortion is just merely the removal of tissue from the womb of the mother, inconvenience, for various reasons. That's one example that we can now tell if a baby's going to be handicapped or not. So if it is, then get rid of it. Survival of the fittest. This is all done under this mentality. Yeah. And that's where it leads to. And you see, I mean, like, he gives the example of Hitler. And they eliminated millions of people. But that's going on every year in practically every country in the world now, including India. India has the highest abortion rates of any country in the world. In America, at least 1.5 to 2 million babies every year are aborted. And this is typical of most countries. In Russia, every woman on average has at least 8 abortions. 8 abortions. Now, I remember when the abortion debate was first going on, and it was brought up that this will just be used for economic ideas. That, you know, when a person can't afford a baby, they'll use this abortion law now to just get rid of them. And there was the proponents were saying, no, that will never happen. You know, this is just for cases where, you know, a woman gets raped or, you know, something like that happens, then she has the right to get rid of that baby. Why should she have to suffer, you know, with the consequences of her rape for the rest of her life or whatever? So this was all the arguments. But nowadays, the most common cause of abortion is economic. That the couple can't afford to have the baby, and so they get rid of them. That's all. And it's become a standard, you know, method of contraception. Have sex, get pregnant, and then kill it. So this is the unfortunate state. This is all modern science. Yeah. It's due to this misunderstanding of material nature, what our nature is, and elimination of God. As soon as you eliminate the Supreme Personality of Godhead, then means you become God, like Ernst Haeckel. Basically what he's saying is, I will decide who's fit to live and who needs to die. And without a second thought, just eliminate thousands of living beings. No problem. Finish that. Then what happens when somebody decides that it's your turn, that you're not fit? Ernst Haeckel becomes an old man. Then somebody comes up and said, all right, now we have to eliminate you. You're past the age of 65. You're no longer any use to society. What will he say? So this is, you know, all due to a lack of God consciousness. That's the whole point. So the last thing that I'm going to show, we probably have enough time, if I can get this up properly. I had it all set up before, but unfortunately, so I'll look at the miracle received.
As wind will soon see, a grain of pollen no larger than a speck of dust has a wonderful design of amazing complexity.
This is pollen. Plant life.
God has created millions of different plants and the millions of grains of pollen that these plants need. A large amount of this pollen is carried by the wind. These little grains are responsible for the allergies that many people have in the spring. When pollen reaches the organelles of another plant, where the egg cell lies, it fertilizes that cell. Use animals as special couriers to transport their pollen. The couriers they use most are insects. Because of the colors, sweet smells, and nectar that God has given them, flowers attract insects. When we look carefully at the relationship between flowers and insects, we see the harmony in the creation of these living things. Of course, the wonderful design of pollen and plants was not created by the plants themselves. The wonderful methods used to spread pollen constitute only one of the countless examples of God's perfect creation. South Africa. There is a long tube under its leaves. The nectar and pollen lie at the bottom of this tube. To reach them, a really long drilling pipe is required. And a flying device is needed to keep the drilling pipe suspended in the air. God, who created this flower with an incomparable artistry of beauty, also created the system it needs to regenerate. This is a Hoover fly. Because of its long drilling pipe, it can reach the flower's deepest point. It must land on the flower vertically so that its drilling pipe will not bend. It was also provided with the flying system it needs. It can remain suspended in the air like a helicopter. For a helicopter to land safely, guiding signs are used. Now, look at the white arrows on the flower. They all point to one spot guiding the Hoover fly. In this way, the Hoover fly can alight on the right spot. What we see here is clear. and no brain to make it think. Despite this, it has signs on it to guide an insect. An insect is also a creature without consciousness. But it too has in it all the technical design needed to reach the pollen and the nectar. Surely the consciousness that provides this flawless harmony does not belong to an insect or a plant. It is Almighty God who knows the qualities possessed by every living thing and creates them from nothing to be in harmony with one another. As it is enjoined in one of the verses of the Quran, everyone in the heavens and earth belongs to Him. All are submissive to Him. Some plants resort to a very interesting method to attract insects. They offer them perfume. One species of orchid that grows in South America produces a special perfume in its leaves. The customers for this perfume are male bees, who use this perfume to attract females. Throughout the centuries, people have been using perfumes and essences to smell good. For bees, as well as human beings, it is important to smell good. But the orchid does not give away its perfume for nothing. It has a wonderfully designed and harmless trap for the bees. Thanks to this trap, it can load its pollen onto them. There is a very slippery floor at the entrance to the place where the perfume is. It is very difficult for the male bee to land there. Of course, there is a reason for the slippery floor. Now, watch carefully. The bee falls into the trap. As he struggles to escape, he comes into contact with the yellow pollen. And the pollen sticks to the bee's body. The wonderful trap has worked. Another species of orchid uses another method to load its pollen. A booby trap. There is a very sweet-smelling nectar here to attract bees. That extension you see is the orchid's booby trap. This bee you see is not big enough to set the trap mechanism into motion. But this one is. The bee comes into contact with the trap's trigger mechanism, and in a split second, pollen sticks to the bee.
The next one is a real funeral. This is what I mean.
The design of the cypress orchid is another wonder of creation. The designs you see on the screen are a one-to-one model of a female bee. These are blue wing-shaped designs. There are hair-like projections on the body. In the sunlight, the wings of a female bee take on a blue color. And just like the orchid, its body is covered with hairs. The orchid imitates the female bee perfectly. Yet, this is not the whole miracle. The female bee excretes a special chemical substance to attract the male bee. It is amazing that the orchid produces the same chemical substance to attract the male bee. So, the pollen sticks to it. The male bee takes this pollen with it when it goes to another orchid, and the other orchid is fertilized by the pollen. Here we see another miracle of creation. An orchid is a plant. It has no eyes to see the outside world and no brain to interpret what it sees. The fact that a plant can imitate a living thing it has never seen and can never know, from its wings to its hairs and from its color to its smell, is proof that God created both the plant and the bee. African female wasp has no wings. She spends a large amount of her time under the ground. When it comes time to mate, the female bee comes to the surface and climbs up a plant. There she secretes a special odor to attract male wasps and waits for them to arrive. And usually she does not have to wait long. The male wasp flies to her, picks her up, and they fly away together. The reproductive system of the hammer orchid that grows in South Africa is another miracle of creation, and it has a wonderful engineering design. The flower part of the orchid resembles a wingless female wasp. The flower produces a copy of the perfume produced by the female wasp. The male wasp thinks that this miniature model is a female wasp and tries to fly away with it. But of course, he can't. So, what's the use of this to the orchid? The answer lies hidden in the orchid's ingenious design. The purple area on the left is a model of the female wasp. In the little sac on the right, there is sticky pollen. This compartment, which includes the model of the female wasp, is attached to the plant by a small but strong joint. When stimulated, this joint allows the female wasp model to move towards the pollen sac. When the bee attempts to pick up the female and fly away, he comes into contact with the pollen sac because of this mechanical design. There, the pollen is stuck to the bee.
Okay, there's lots more, but it's 20 to 12. So there's some very practical examples of completeness. And as Prabhupada said, you just have to look at nature. The units that come from the Supreme Personality of Godhead are complete in themselves. Every living system is complete. There are complete arrangements for all the living beings to get what they need in this material world. And of course, as human beings, there's another complete arrangement for getting out of the material world, which is the Vedas, complete explanation of how everything is working, what a living being is, what this material universe is, what time is, what activity is to be performed, and what lies beyond the universe, where real happiness lies. So every system, every living system has a completeness to it, and you only have to see it. And then you understand what this means. Om Purnam Adah Purnam Idam. Everything is complete. Every unit that comes from it is complete. And nothing is lost. You create something. Prabhupada gives the example. He was giving a lecture. He said, just like I have this glass of water, I drink the water, I put the glass down, immediately it's filled with water again. Yeah, nothing lost. I drink it, again, it's filled with water. That is Krishna. Doesn't matter how much comes from him, he still remains the complete Supreme Personality of Godhead. Any questions? Yes.
The statement of that Muslim preacher, it's incomplete.
Yes.
Because he talks about the submission of the, from the Bible, from the Torah. He talks about the submission of the creation from him, but it does not acknowledge the living soul within the plant.
Yes.
By that statement, and
he makes these comments again and again throughout his films, that he says that this living being has no consciousness. Mm-hmm. And that's their shortcoming in their presentation. Because as soon as you say that, then you have to say, well, then that means that that is just a mechanism. It's an admittance that other living beings are just mechanisms and nothing more. Then how do you explain the loving feelings that this exhibits? Because they say, well, that's just due to the consciousness of God.
The statement justify their meaning, that's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, it can be used in various ways, and there are many shortcomings. The Christians also have the same idea. They don't account for certain aspects of life, and, you know, living beings as they are with their own consciousness. Only in the Vedas do you find a complete explanation. This is a, you know, because the Muslims in my Vedas, their conception of God is just some impersonal absolute. They don't have a personal conception of God. In fact, they think that the personal conception of God is offensive. That's why when Aurangzeb was on the rampage here in India, they went around. You'll see many temples in Vrindavan. The figures that are carved onto the wall, so all the faces have been broken off, or the hands have been broken off, Muslims, because they think it's an offense to represent God in a personal way. So they're all Maya values. And, it's incomplete. To not come to the position of recognizing the supreme form of God, then you can't recognize the living beings that either in their completeness. If we're parts and parcels of the Supreme Lord, then that means we have the same attributes, we have the same qualities, so the qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are thinking, feeling and willing, consciousness, and we think and feel and will, and all living beings think and feel and will, and that is evidenced, you know, when you actually look at nature. Sometimes when I went into Prabhupada's room in the morning after he'd been translating, especially here in India, he would be sitting and looking underneath the desk lamp, and there'd be, you know, various little bugs there that had been attracted in the night time by the lamp. And where was that? I think we were at Hari Prasad Badruka's house. This was in August of 76 in Hyderabad. And I went into Prabhupada's room, and then there were some little bugs, you know, crawling around the light, and he was saying, just see, everything is there. They also have, you know, a sense of everything. And then he put his finger, there was one little bug crawling on the table, he put his finger in right in front of it, and the bug stopped, and then it, you know, went round, and then Prabhupada put his finger again in front of it, and it stopped again, and it went round another way. And he was showing, he said, just see, everything is there. They know what's going on. They know their business. So consciousness is there, but it's not developed. That's the whole point. And as living beings, we don't say that living beings are created. We don't say that. Living beings are eternal, as Krishna is eternal. So we have some differences, but at least they accept that God exists. And that nothing has come about by chance, and nothing has come about by just combinations of chemicals. Although their deficiency is that they are ultimately saying that they are just mechanisms that somehow or another operate because there's another consciousness acting upon them. But our Vedic concept is more complete. There's consciousness in the living being, there's consciousness in the supreme living being, and there's an interaction between them. And the reason why all these systems exist is to facilitate the desires of those individual living beings. according to their activities in previous lives and according to the desires that they develop, they get a specific kind of body which enables them to enjoy in particular ways. That's why those systems are there. Now, you won't get that explanation, you know, from the Muslims or Christians or the creation scientists. They can't really explain why everything is there. Ultimately, they'll say, well, it's just there for our enjoyment. They don't know the higher purpose behind it. So there are some limitations to their idea, because they don't have a complete understanding of the personality of Godhead. As soon as you talk about personality, everything falls into place. But if you don't see the personality, then you'll be lacking in some way or other. Yes, Rabbi.
Well, they just say that's why they show when they show different animals and so on. They try to show the world in a very nice light. It's little like the opposite. The Darwin's theory was everything is just everybody's trying to eat each other, and they try to show like the material world is the perfect place. Because it's created by God, so we can stay here and enjoy it.
Yes, yeah, it's a good point. And the material creation is not perfect. It is complete. And it's perfect and complete in the sense of what it's designed for. But you have to see what the design is meant for. Yeah. Just like in a prison house, there's a complete system for looking after the prisoners. Yeah. Fooding, clothing, little work, somewhere to stay. You know, somebody to look after you. The whole system works very nicely. It's complete. But the prison in itself is still a prison. You know, that's not actually the real life that the person should be enjoying. So in the material world, we see it from that perspective. The problem there is that they don't see or they don't know that there's anything beyond this material universe. The only thing that they know is that there is this material universe. And the only way that they see God's interaction in their lives is within this material atmosphere, yeah? Within the material context. They never talk about what's beyond the universe, because they have no information. But the Vedas give us that information, yeah, about Vaikuntha, about Goloka Vrindavan. So we get a more complete picture of what so-called creation is. Of what reality is, actually. Okay, so it's 10 to 12. We'll finish at that point. Shiva Prabhupada.